proceed with our next case. It's case number 63177, Quarantine versus Z Capital Partners. We have Mr. Weiss for the appellants, Mr. McCray for the respondents. I know we gave you each 15 minutes. I think we were probably overly optimistic on that. So let's do 20 minutes each side. And Mr. Weiss, you can then reserve part of that 20 minutes. You can let us know how much you want to reserve. And we'll see how we go from there. Also, as you can see, Justice Hardesty is in Carson City. He is in the courtroom there, and he'll participate with the arguments from Carson City. He's also, Tracy Lindeman, our court clerk, has scanned the handout, I guess the parties have, and Justice Hardesty does have that, because he won't be able to see the board up here. The only thing I'd like to say is, I know, feel free to point to the boards, and the opposing counsel is free to get up if they want when you do so, but if you're speaking, please stay by the podium, because we need to pick it up on our audio as well. Okay, with that in mind, and Justice Sada is not here, but she will participate in the decision. We'll listen to the podcast of this oral argument.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Todd Weiss on behalf of the appellants. I will present the argument on behalf of all appellants today, although obviously with me at counsel table is Tammy Peterson, who is the company's counsel. We represented the board members below. But in the interest of brevity and of time, I'll present the argument on behalf of all appellants. We appeal a preliminary injunction order entered on May 10 of 2013 in favor of appellee Z Capital, or collectively Z Capital, which imposed five sweeping restraints in the form of a preliminary injunction, all of which can frankly be summarized into a prohibition that requires the board of directors not to do anything that supposedly adversely, materially impacts the interests of Z Capital, however Z Capital chooses to define it.
Mr. Weiss, one thing I can add, I know the court had one question. They were interested in how the bankruptcy proceedings and the reorganization affect the rights of the parties, because we have some federal law issues there, and if you feel that's part of the calculus in your argument, please feel free to address that as well.
I don't believe it is a calculus of the argument, because what happened is that the entity emerged from bankruptcy and the operating agreement was what came into operation as a result of the post-bankruptcy okay. events, and then the conversion occurred approximately 2 years after that. So I don't believe that it does enter into the calculus. Now, the district court entered this injunction based upon nothing but a verified complaint. There was not any affidavits of the party of by Z Capital, of anyone with actual personal knowledge of this. Again, the only thing they presented were some exhibits and a verified complaint. Notwithstanding the fact that two of the then existing board members, Mr. David Ross and Mr. Don Kornstein, had submitted detailed declarations in opposition to the motion for a preliminary injunction, of which no rebuttal was provided by Z Capital. With the time available, and again, I apologize, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. In the time available, I'd like to focus on what I believe are three really interrelated points. The first being the quintessential issue on any preliminary injunction, even though it's typically referred to as the second element of any claim for preliminary injunction, it's still the most, it seems to be the most important, and that is there irreparable harm here? Has there been an evidentiary showing of imminent irreparable harm which warrants the need for judicial intervention before the truth can be determined? Because after all, that's what a trial is for. A trial is to determine what is the truth. Here we have an injunction that was entered before that truth, before any search for the truth had even begun. Then the next point I'd like to address is just going to that issue about the underlying merits and the lack of an evidentiary basis for that. And then finally, sort of overarching all of this is an injunction, the terms of which are really a gift to Z Capital. It accomplishes exactly what they wanted. It turned a minority shareholder into virtually control of the company because it serves as, it's not a shield against prohibiting actions. It's a sword by which this minority shareholder can wield it at the board with a constant threat of criminal proceedings or criminal contempt if they don't do what Z Capital likes. That is particularly, I think, inappropriate in the context of disputes over control of corporations, let alone corporations that are subject to Nevada's gaming regulations. Now, briefly, just the facts, the basic facts giving rise to this dispute. As you know from the briefs, Herbst Gaming, Inc. went into bankruptcy. During that bankruptcy process, the lenders converted into equity and all entered into an operating agreement that resulted in an entity called Herbst Gaming, LLC.
So the bankruptcy plan wiped out the Herbst shareholders and the lenders took 100% of the equity. Is that correct?
You're just given, I can't represent to you that none of the equity holders in the original Herbst Gaming didn't somehow survive, because I just don't know the answer.
Okay. It may not be relevant. Okay. We just want to understand the background. Then.
So the as outlined in the declarations of Mr. Ross and Mr. Kornstein, which are at 1605 of the appendix and 1611 of the appendix, respectively. Now, these are highly experienced gaming executives, and they were among five people selected by the new owners of this entity to become the board of directors. And almost immediately, as they had outlined to the district court, almost immediately they encountered difficulty in operating this type of an entity as an LLC because of restrictions on transferability, tax consequences, and a host of related issues which are all outlined in their declarations. So that was anticipated even prior to the entry of the operating agreement, because the operating agreement contained an express provision that contemplated the conversion of the LLC into a Nevada corporation. And notably, and that's section 7.15 of the agreement. Now, notably, section 7.15 of the agreement provides that it was up to the board, it could either be a vote of the majority members of the operating agreement, or the board could vote for the conversion. Now, that's contrary, actually, to what Nevada law would have otherwise provided, now, because the Nevada statute in Chapter 92A says that the board of the members, a majority interest of the members, are what are necessary to provide for a conversion, of course, unless the operating agreement provides otherwise, which this one did. And that becomes rather significant as we move forward. This process about the conversion actually first arose in the beginning of 2011, as outlined by Mr. Kornstein's declaration. As they went through this process and encountered a lot of various obstacles in the operation of this gaming enterprise as an LLC, and the transferability of interest and the tax consequences and the like, they then later in that process was moving along. They examined it originally. Then it picked up some steam in or around September, the fall of 2012. And that steam was picked up in Northmore Park because the boards formed a special operations or opportunities committee, I apologize, that examined a lot of different options in terms of what can we do going forward with this LLC. That process ultimately culminated in December of 2012 with a plan of conversion, and that plan of conversion was approved by the board and went into effect on December 20 of 2012. Now, at about the same time, even before the conversion, as Mr. Kornstein and Mr. Ross detail in their declarations, the board began examining whether or not a shareholders' rights plan made sense for this, for the interest of all shareholders and the interest of the entity. Mm-hmm. Of course, as this court knows, shareholder rights plans are spelled out in detail, and the authority for them is in detail in NRS Chapter 78-195 sub 5, specifically providing that nothing in the statute restricts the board's ability of a corporation to implement such a rights plan in order to protect the interest of the corporation and all shareholders should a certain shareholder attempt to acquire a percentage of shares above a certain threshold that is within the board's discretion to determine. Now, at the time that these parties entered into that operating agreement that specifically provided that it could be converted, they clearly had to know what the law of Nevada was regarding the ability of the board to adopt such a rights plan. They entered into a provision, into an operating agreement governed by Nevada law, nonetheless. With that, the board had contemplated the adoption of this rights plan. They make the conversion, they adopt the plan of conversion on December 20, and at that same time, or immediately thereafter, I apologize, immediately thereafter, they adopt what is known as a rights plan. Now, you're going to hear Z Capital call it a poison pill because that's, of course, an ominous term But nonetheless, these are commonly accepted mechanisms for the interest of shareholders, of all shareholders, and in order to protect the corporation, and are governed by the Nevada's business judgment rule, which is set out, again, in detail under the Nevada revised statutes. After that assault happened in the beginning of December of 2012, Z Capital then approached the company on February 10 of 2013 in writing, and again, this is at 1660 of the appendix. They submitted a written offer to acquire all outstanding shares of the company at $14 per share. That offer then expired 5 days later, and Z Capital had announced thereafter that it was no longer interested in acquiring the company or acquiring control over the company. And in fact, they later confirmed this after they had filed suit and at the preliminary injunction hearing, because what they said was, we no longer have any interest in acquiring the company or control thereof, but that doesn't mean that we don't have an interest in acquiring, these are their terms again, I want to make sure I quote them correctly, we'd like to buy a few more percentage interests in it. At that point in time, I believe they held around 30%. So a few more percentage interests was not going to give them control of the corporation in any regard. That was the extent of their claim. They filed suit. I believe it was about March 5th, if my memory serves me correctly. And then they later sought a preliminary injunction on or about a month later, around April the 8th. Now, while that was ongoing, I think it was prior to them filing suit, because it was February 20th, Affinity announced that it was going to hold its annual shareholders meeting and its stockholders meeting, which it had then set for May 14, 2013. When they filed the motion for preliminary injunction, by all appearances, it was designed apparently to stop them from, to stop the board from holding the vote. That later changed and sort of morphed as the motion proceeded. They filed this motion. Hearing was open. An opposition was filed along with these detailed declarations, and the hearing was held. At the hearing, their position essentially was, well, you can't adopt, this is, Mr. McRae's language was essentially, this is a different kind of an animal. Apparently, it's not really a corporation, and it's not really an LLC. It's some sort of a foreign hybrid, whereby it's a corporation, but still, the LLC operating agreement somehow plays some trump role with respect to the corporation, notwithstanding its articles of incorporation.
Didn't the agreement and plan of conversion specifically spell out that the operating agreement shall have no further force or effect?
Correct, it did.
Okay.
That is exactly
how
right. How do they argue around that? Just fair day. That's their point. That's their position, though. Their position is notwithstanding the terms of Nevada law that you can't have a corporation that's subject to an LLC agreement. Their position is, well, inside Section 7.15, there was a sentence that said that upon the conversion, of course, this is their board over here, upon the conversion, they claimed that the shares that they would be issued, and this is again spelled out in 7.15, The shares that they would receive shares and rights, they claim, that are commensurate with or substantially equivalent, to use the precise terminology, to the rights that they had under the operating agreement when they held interest in the LLC. But of course, you can't tell us that, let me back up a little bit because I'm not being clear on this. If you look at Section 7.15, what it provides is there were four different mechanisms by which they could accomplish this conversion, one of which was simply forming the conversion process itself as authorized under the statute. The second one was a merger. A third one was a sale of substantially all of the assets. Now, interestingly, this provision provided that these decisions could be made exclusively by the board of directors without any consent or approval by the membership. The provision upon which they rely to say that this gets trumped is Section 7.6 of the agreement. But Section 7.6 of the agreement specifies when certain votes have to be held of the membership. Well, the first two of those are for a merger or for a sale of substantially all of the assets. They have the, I would submit, exactly backwards. 7.6 doesn't trump 7.15. The opposite is the case. You can't reconcile those two provisions because Section 7.15 says that it's either the board or a majority vote of the membership. They clearly had to know what Nevada law was at the time that they entered into this operating agreement. And Nevada law clearly provides that upon the conversion, the corporation, like all corporations, is controlled by its articles of incorporation, not some residual hybrid entity by which now we have vestiges of a smorgasbord approach of, well, I'd like to pick and choose certain provisions out of an operating agreement that I like, jettison those I don't like, and then take the provisions of the articles of incorporation that I like and reject those that I don't like. That's the position that they have taken, is that this is some sort of a hybrid legal entity that Nevada law, apparently, they're asking you to now recognize that doesn't exist in the statutes.
Well, Mr. Bice.
Yes, Justice Hardesty.
What is the effect, then, of 7.15? It seems to contemplate the after effect of the corporate conversion. So whether the method for corporate conversion is established by the board in its judgment or by a vote of the membership, the outcome seems to be characterized in 7.15 that everyone's corporate ownership in stock remains the same.
Correct. I would submit that what it says is it has to be substantially equivalent in terms of their ownership, so which, of course, as of the date of conversion, I apologize, Justice Hardesty.
No, go ahead and finish your answer. The video is a problem for us. I apologize.
As of the date of conversion, they held the exact same rights that they held immediately prior to the conversion. What they're protesting is that after the conversion, the board then took additional steps that they say somehow impacted their rights, which the board was authorized to do under Nevada law as a corporation, and that process then proceeded to occur. And now they're complaining that, well, you shouldn't have been allowed to implement this rights plan, which provisions of Nevada corporate law in NRS Chapter 78 specifically authorize.
Could you help me out here a little? Are the provisions contained in the rights plan at variance from the provisions contained in 7.15?
No, and they are not at variance, because if you look at the rights plan, what the rights plan provided for is the rights plan set up when the corporation was formed. All Nevada corporations have to have a stock amount. As we put in the briefs, unlike the operating agreement where interests can just simply be created by the board, at the time of the formation of a corporation, all of its both issued and authorized stock is created all at once. Mm-hmm. So the board was authorized upon the conversion, or at the time of the conversion, to create the authorized shares. Those shares were never issued, and in fact haven't been issued as of this date, and they have no legal effect. What they are claiming is now is that this corporation, it's now a corporation, is frozen into eternity by selective provisions of an operating agreement that by its express terms went away upon the date of the conversion. And that, of course, is their problem, because the operating agreement has to go away. It cannot continue to control the operations of a Nevada corporation. And in fact, the remaining provisions of Section 7.15 confirm that, Justice Hardesty, because the last sentence of it, or the second to the last sentence of it, specifically contemplates the potential for a future agreement to memorialize certain rights at the board's direction, or at the company's discretion. If this operating agreement was intended to survive that conversion, that provision would be utterly meaningless and would serve no purpose. So it cannot continue to control the affairs of the company after the fact, and they having chosen to convert this and authorize the conversion of it into a Nevada corporation knew full well what the consequences or what the rights were of a board of directors under a Nevada corporation to adopt a rights plan for the protection of all shareholders, which is what they have done.
Mr. Bice, can you tell me, at this hearing, it indicates there was a one-day hearing in court, where it was an evidentiary hearing with witnesses?
It was not.
But they had findings of fact and conclusions of law.
They made findings of fact and conclusions of law that were prepared by Zacapa and submitted, and the court did approve them.
And the court only granted a preliminary injunction, not didn't consolidate it under Rule 65.
It did not. It granted the preliminary injunction. Now, I'd like to turn just briefly because of the time constraints, and I apologize for being a little long-winded, but turn to this issue because, as I said, one of the principal points I would submit is the just abject lack of any irreparable harm here. In order to sort through this, you know, you would have a trial on the merits, you'd have discovery. That, of course, never happened, and the plan was enjoined under the theory that, well, and again, to borrow the district court's language here, I just want to make sure I put it correctly, the extent of the argument was essentially that they were denied the use and enjoyment of their relative equity position. Well, with all due respect to the district court, I don't know what that means, because they certainly were not denied any voting rights. They had the right to vote their shares. In fact, they did vote their shares. They lost the proxy contest because the shareholders rejected their proposals and rejected their attempt to install Mr. Zinni and the general counsel on the board of directors. And that election was, they had the right to cast all their votes and did so, just like all the shareholders did. Their position in front of the district court, once they conceded that they had no intention of acquiring the entity, they could not claim any further any form of irreparable harm. Because by saying, well, we want to acquire a few additional percentages, well, that can be measured by money if it turns out that you had the right to do that and had been deprived of it. And recall, a panel of this court, when we had sought a stay of this injunction, denied our motion. I see I've run out of time already. If I could just take a short period of time to wrap this up.
Well, I'm going to give you 5 minutes of rebuttal and give opposing counsel an additional 5 minutes because of the complex nature of the issues. I want to make sure we get a full understanding of everything here.
All right, thank you, Mr.
Okay, so we'll give Mr. McCray 25 minutes. And Mr. McCray, one question I had, and you go ahead and proceed with your presentation, but if the LLC was replaced by the corporation, operating agreements run LLCs, they don't run corporations. The board of directors runs the corporation here. So how can you have this kind of hybrid where the operating agreement carries over to the corporation's operations and all after the reorganization?
Thank you, Justice Gibbons. Charles McCray for the record.
Thank you. I'm sorry I didn't mean to preempt you, but I wanted to get that question out before I forgot. You know.
With me is Martin Auerbach. He's the general counsel for
Zacapa. Oh, very well. Thank you. Mr. Auerbach.
Your Honor, we're not arguing that this is some kind of a hybrid between an LLC and a corporation. I don't recall ever making that argument. What is clear from the operating agreement is that this LLC could be converted into a corporation, obviously contemplates that. But it also specifies what protections have to be given to the equity holders of the LLC post-conversion. And it guarantees those equity holders that they will have substantially equivalent rights of governance, economic interests, priorities, and everything else that they have with the LLC. Mm-hmm. And that's the rub here. You can't look at this conversion and the adoption of the rights, so-called rights plan, mm-hmm. as two separate, independent, unrelated occurrences. What happened here was a scheme of corporate conversion. It clearly contemplated the immediate adoption of the rights agreement.
Couldn't they file a derivative suit, though, and deal with it through damages? Or how is the injunction the proper remedy?
Because damages are impossible to calculate here, Your Honor. What this rights plan does, and this is part and parcel of the corporate conversion, mm-hmm. is that it freeze Z Capital's investment in this mm-hmm. company. It prohibits Z Capital from acquiring one additional share, and it prohibits Z Capital from selling blocks of stock that would cause any other acquirer, whether they're an existing shareholder or not, to own 15% or more of the stock. So it has a tremendous chilling effect on the value of Z Capital's investment. Nothing like this existed prior to the conversion and the adoption of that poison pill. Z Capital had the absolute right to acquire as much equity in the company as they wanted and not risk catastrophic dilution, which will occur if they acquire just one more share. And likewise, they were entitled to sell whatever they wanted to sell of their investment of whatever size without risk of having the acquirer being catastrophically diluted. One of the boards that I brought with me. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. McRae, accepting your argument, the order granting preliminary injunction seems to go much broader than that. The protections afforded in the injunction seem to address broadly economic interests. I don't even know how you enforce that. Could you comment on the breadth of that portion? I mean, I recognize your argument about creating parity or consistency with respect to your clients' stock ownership and membership rights before and after the conversion. But this provision here that is included in the injunction seems to go much further than that when it talks about protecting your clients' economic interests and so on and so forth.
Justice Augustine, the preliminary injunction finds the fact that rules of law should be read in their entirety, and all they do is restore the status quo that existed with respect to the rights of the equity holders prior to the conversion.
Well, is there anything in the agreement that precludes the corporation when it is formed from creating preferred shares as a separate category of stock as long as your client gets some?
There is Section 7.1 in the operating agreement which says that I'm quoting from it here, the members of the company shall be entitled to vote on the election of directors in such matters as would require the approval of shareholders of a corporation organized under 78 of NRS. And one of the provisions of NRS 78 is the provision that requires shareholder approval for the adoption of resolutions authorizing the issuance of any shares, any kind of shares, preferred or otherwise, that would adversely affect that shareholder.
But aren't those provisions at odds with the analysis provided by Mr. Bice that one way to proceed with this corporate conversion is through the board's election, and by statute they can proceed to create this conversion and establish those disparate stock ownerships, can't they?
We would submit, Your Honor, that they can't, because their powers are limited by the statutes and by the operating agreement. The operating agreement doesn't disappear, or the obligations of the operating agreement don't disappear upon the conversion. It's still a contract. Mm-hmm. And the managers of the LLC were bound by that contract.
So what statute precludes the board from creating preferred stock at the time of the conversion?
If it's going to be issued for the if that preferred stock is going to be issued to other equity holders in any kind of a disparate way, it would require the vote of those equity holders. Under NRS Then I was 78-390 sub 2.
But do we know now how the preferred stock is to be issued? I don't read that in the rights plan, but maybe I'm missing something.
As I understand the rights plan, Your Honor, the preferred shares have been issued. And once the rights plan is triggered, the rights of those preferred shares are triggered.
But I didn't think any shares have been issued yet.
No common shares have been issued.
But the preferreds have been?
The issues have been. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I stand corrected. They have not been issued. But if the price plan is triggered, then every shareholder except us gets the preferred share, which are then convertible into common shares. Okay. And the effect that this would have on...
So your dispute is how the triggering event is established in the rights plan.
Our dispute is the rights plan in its entirety. And the events that trigger the issuance of these shares that catastrophically dilute.
And so those are at variance then with what your expectations are under 7.15. Is that your argument?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think it is important to understand the genesis of this action and how we came to be where we are at this moment. This goes back to the time when Hearst Gaming filed bankruptcy. eCapital has been a long-time investor in Hearst Gaming. They were a secured debt holder of Hearst Gaming. They and the other secured debt holders of Hearst Gaming could have demanded that their rights as a secured creditor be enforced. They could have forced the sale of the assets of Hearst Gaming and effectively dissolved the company. But instead they agreed to have their debt converted into equity and in the process allowed their business enterprise to continue operating. But they did so in the context of an agreement. It was extensively negotiated, carefully negotiated, and provided the equity holders at that time, or the creditors at that time, that would become equity holders, certain protections that they demanded. And those protections are embodied in Section 7.15 of the operating agreement. They are embodied in Section 12.1 of the agreement and elsewhere. But the essence of those protections are set forth in 7.15, which says quite clearly that no conversion to a corporation shall occur if it does not provide the equity holders substantially equivalent economic interests, governance, priority, and other rights and privileges that they had immediately prior to the conversion. And you can't concoct some scheme where you have a conversion and immediately adopt this rights agreement that deprives the equity holders of those rights that they had prior to the conversion, which is what occurred here, in which Judge Denton quite properly found was in violation of the operating agreement.
What about the scope of the injunction? That was just a sorry badge, and there was other issues in there. Do you feel it's overbroad in any way?
I don't feel that the scope of the injunction went any further than to provide that the rights agreement is unenforceable pending the trial of this case. I believe that is the essence of the preliminary injunction. I think that was...
And you don't believe you have an adequate remedy of law and damages?
We don't, Your Honor. Well, it would... To calculate damages in this case would require, to calculate them in any accurate fashion, would require the triggering of the poison pill. You'd have to do something that would trigger that, and you'd be diluted catastrophically. It'd be like putting a gun to our head, shooting ourselves, and then coming in and suing for the damages. I don't think that the damages could be calculated.
And isn't that the holding in Hilton versus ITT, Judge Pro's holding, in essence?
I believe that the holding is that irreparable harm in cases like this is presumed.
Yeah.
Because interfering with the voting rights of shareholders and the rights to exercise corporate governance is something that just presumes irreparable harm. I think that's also the holding in the Schoen versus Amoco case, the federal court.
Mr. McCray, let me ask you one procedural issue. Let's say we agreed with you, like that, and we affirmed the preliminary injunction. In this case, do the appellants have the right to go to trial in this with a full evidentiary hearing when you seek a permanent injunction and air all these issues out? Or do you feel this will be conclusive, this preliminary injunction?
No, Judge Denton was pretty clear in his order that those findings were preliminary. And I believe that they were based on substantial evidence that, as he saw it at the time, through the verified complaint, and they would be subject to.
Were there affidavits and all filed as well as the verified complaint?
There were declarations filed by the appellants.
Okay.
This was accomplished on an order shortening time, and. We filed the motion, they filed their opposition, and we had a hearing.
Okay.
There was no opportunity to file rebutting affidavits or declarations prior to the hearing of the preliminary injunction. There's one statutory provision I would like to emphasize with respect to the effect that the operating agreement has in this case. The operating agreement, of course, specifically contemplates the corporate conversion, and it specifically conditions any corporate conversion on ensuring that the rights and interests of the equity holders prior to conversion are essentially the same after conversion. In NRS 86.286 sub 4 sub B, which we cited in our briefs, makes clear that operating agreements must be interpreted, I'm quoting here, must be interpreted and construed to give the maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract and enforceability. This operating agreement survives the corporate conversion to the extent the corporate conversion does not comply with the terms of the operating agreement. Otherwise, the operating agreement would have no effect, and to hold the contrary to that would be in direct contravention of the statute.
Now, let me ask you this. During the proceedings, in which you all made the determination to take an equity position as opposed to any other option that was available to you. Wasn't this contemplated that there would be a corporate conversion? Was that ever discussed? Was that part of the negotiation? Was that part of the consideration? How did this come to be?
I wasn't party to those negotiations.
And I appreciate that.
But I assume because it is in the operating agreement, it must have been contemplated. The operating agreement clearly provides that the LLC can be converted into a corporation under certain conditions, either by vote of a majority of the equity holders or by a consensus of the management, as long as the protections that are set forth in 7.15 are honored. And that wasn't done here. The adoption of this poison pill was shareholders' rights agreement in conjunction with the corporate conversion clearly violated the terms of the operating agreement. We're not complaining about the corporate conversion itself. It's what they created post-conversion to this scheme that we are complaining.
Mr. McRae, second provision of the injunction prohibits appellants from authorizing or issuing any additional shares of securities convertible into or exercisable for shares equal to or in excess of 20% of the outstanding common stock of the company without shareholder approval. Do any other shareholders own 20% or more of the stock in the company besides Z Capital?
I believe, yes, there's one shareholder, Silver Point, owns in excess of 20%.
So, who's Silver Point?
They're another investment firm.
So they're a third party, affiliated with everybody else.
No, I mean, they're operating behind the scenes here. They have their nominees are the board of directors. They effectively have control of the corporation. They have an agreement with other shareholders together aggregating 51% of the company.
Wouldn't the rights agreement apply to them in the same way that you're calculating the application to you?
Apparently not.
Why not? I don't quite understand why the calculation isn't the same as to them.
Your Honor, the agreement by which they aggregated 51% was entered into after the injunction was issued, so they were protected by this injunction, the preliminary injunction.
Wait, can you say that again?
I don't follow that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, after the preliminary injunction was issued in this case, Silver Point Capital, I believe is what their name is, entered into an agreement with a half a dozen other shareholders, which together brought them to the 51%. And it would have triggered the shareholder rights agreement, but for the existence of the preliminary injunction.
But before, if I may, Chief, just one more question on this. Before the agreement you say they entered into post-preliminary injunction, the injunction itself prohibits provision in the rights agreement, which I understand to be one of the parts of the poison pill, and that is that anybody who has 20% of the outstanding common stock of the company is going to be subjected to these calculations that you show us on page 2 of your handout, which would result in the same calculation as to them as you have applied to yourself in limiting the number of shares you could get through this preferred stock scheme. If I use the word scheme using your words. Why isn't the calculation the same as to Silver Point as it is to you?
It would be if the rights agreement was in effect, but it has been enjoined.
Yeah, right. So I guess the impact on your company is the same as on Silver Point if the rights agreement remains in effect. They can't acquire preferred stock either.
Right. As long as the injunction is in effect.
Okay, thank you.
You still have over 3 minutes left.
Okay. I believe the issues before this court are clear. One is, it needs to determine whether Z Capital has the substantially equivalent rights post-conversion that it had pre-conversion. And the clear answer to that is they do not. They're prohibited from purchasing additional shares. They're greatly restricted in disposing of shares. They are also prohibited from communicating with other shareholders and discussing management issues and how those issues might be resolved by a combined shareholder vote. The poison pill would be triggered by that as well. So their rights are not substantially equivalent. And the next question the court faces is whether the LLC that guaranteed those rights to Z Capital and all other shareholders is enforceable. And it has to be enforceable. If it's not enforceable, then NRS 86-2864B means nothing. And lastly, I think the irreparable harm here is presumed. In addition to that, monetary damages, I believe, would be impossible to calculate.
The court ordered security of $100,000. Was there any objection by your opposing parties to that amount?
Actually, they did object, and there was a subsequent hearing where the bond was increased to $500,000.
Okay.
I think Judge Denton got it right, and the preliminary injunction in his ruling below should be affirmed in this case.
Thank you very much, Mr. McRae. Mr. Bice, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yeah, thank you. For going down the list, I think the list of Mr. McRae's points, Mr. McRae made the assertion that they have the right to acquire shares, and that was one of the valuable rights that they did not have the substantial equivalency of post-conversion that they had allegedly pre-conversion. And I would challenge him to point to any provision of this operating agreement or any provision of Nevada law that says that one has the right to acquire additional interests. And I think that tells you a lot. Because what this plan does, this plan issues the shares apply equally to everyone. The rights plan applies equally to everyone. There is no disparate impact. What happens is that if you start acquiring additional shares, which, by the way, NRS Chapter 78 expressly authorizes boards of Nevada corporations to adopt rights plans that are triggered by the acquisition of certain shares above a certain percentage so that the board can put itself in the middle of those acquisitions to negotiate for the benefit of the entire entity a control premium if it makes sense for the interests of the corporation. When they entered into this operating agreement with a conversion right that rested with the board, they had to know that. And if they wanted to bargain themselves out of that provision, they needed to do so expressly, and they did not do so expressly. Instead, now after the fact, what we've got is we're trying to contrive various provisions and weave them all together and talk about amendments and things like that that somehow are supposed to give us this right, which is nowhere contained in any of the documentation that they signed. And that, I think, is dispositive as to the underlying purported merits of their position. Every shareholder who acquires shares before a corporation adopts a rights plan has the same argument that they have. Well, when I bought these shares, I had an expectation that there was no rights plan in existence when I bought these shares, and I had intended to continue to acquire shares in the future. And now the board, under Nevada law, has adopted a rights plan that says I can't do that without triggering a potential premium for the benefit of the corporation and the other shareholders in the event I want to acquire a controlling stake. That's true of every shareholder, of every corporation. That is not what this provision that they bargained for provides. The rights plan applies equally to everyone, and it only is triggered upon an acquisition. Now we've heard the fallback argument. Well, it prohibits us from selling potential shares in large blocks, and maybe we would be able to get a premium by selling in a large block. Again, that certainly cannot be irreparable harm because they presented zero evidence before the district court that they intended to sell. In fact, we know they didn't intend to sell because they specifically represented to the district court that they wanted to acquire a few more percentages. Again, not control, nothing more. And that comes back to the point that then ties into the fact that there was no irreparable harm here. There can be no irreparable harm when your position is, I want to buy a few more percentages. That can easily be measured. When is it that you wanted to acquire them? What is their value today? Since it's not a control block, you can't claim that you were somehow deprived of certain rights. They presented no evidence of that because there is none. And it could have been measured. Just like when we sought to stay of this injunction, the panel's response to us was, well, you can get money damages if it turns out that they acquire control and there should have been a control premium. The control premium would be your measure of damages. Well, the supposed value in those shares, their incremental due percentage increase, would be the increase in their value. And Justice Pickering, in response to your specific question, I disagree that ITT versus Hilton establishes a presumption, as Mr. McCray says, of an irreparable harm. Not what you, I apologize, you didn't say that, but his position seemed to be that it was. As you recall, better than most of us was heavily involved in that case. Judge Pearl's ruling was, and again, I think it's very critical here, because as he said, the issue there was whether or not, because the ITT board was all up for election, and they did this plan, which would then stagger the board and remove a large percentage of those board members from standing for election. A fundamental disenfranchisement of the voters, of their ability to vote for their directors, which is the principal measure of corporate control. That is the point of that case, and that's what the issue was there. I'm out of time, so.
Thank you all. I mean, thank you again for your excellent arguments and briefs in this case, and we appreciate getting these business court appeals since we just got our business court launched, well, some years ago, but we're good with developing our case law as well, so we appreciate the opportunity to take a look at it. The case will stand submitted, and we'll be in recess until the next call of the court.